KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Of a previous episode, we will not be taking phone calls or emails during today's program. Welcome to Line One, Your Health Connection. I am Dr. Ann Zink, and today we are totally honored to have a friend, colleague, and amazing mentor, Dr. Caitlin Rivers, with us. She's a Johns Hopkins epidemiologist, a mom, a crisis communicator, and author of her new and highly recommended book, Crises Averted, The Hidden Science of Fighting Outbreaks. We're going to start out today by exploring how public health efforts work behind the scenes to prevent crises, especially here in Alaska, where limited healthcare capacity and high costs make prevention absolutely critical. Alaska's unique environment makes prevention essential, and isolation can protect us, but it can also make us vulnerable. And today, we're excited to have you join us, as well as Dr. Caitlin Rivers. Alaskans, we would love to hear from you. How has the public health, how's public health and preventative health helped to keep you and your family safe? Help shine a light on prevention that is often unseen. Please consider joining us in the conversation. In Anchorage, you can give us a call at 907-550-8433 or statewide at 1-888-353-5752, or you can always email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. And so let's go ahead and get started. Welcome, Dr. Caitlin Rivers. It's so great to have you on. I thought we would just take a few minutes to have you introduce yourself to the Alaskan audience, who you are, why you're here, and a little bit about why you chose to write this book.
Yeah, thanks so much. It's great to be with you. My name is Caitlin Rivers. I'm an associate professor at Johns Hopkins, and I'm an epidemiologist, which means I study infectious disease outbreaks. I recently released my first book called Crisis Averted, and I'm really pleased to speak with you all today about some of what I learned along the way writing the book and some of the themes and lessons from the book. And it really emerges from my experience as an epidemiologist specializing in epidemics and pandemics. And so the COVID-19 pandemic was particularly gripping and troubling and everything for me, as it was for so many Americans. So a lot of what I'm looking forward to sharing really arises from those experiences.
Great. Thank you so much. At the very beginning of the book, you talk a little bit about how public health is often unseen. And if we're doing our job, that no one knows, nothing happens. And you talk about exposing those kind of magic threads, those underlying threads of prevention. Tell us a little bit more about what public health does and what made you interested in it to get started.
I like to call public health medicine's quieter cousin. Many people, all of us really, are familiar with the medical system because it's where you go when you are sick or something is wrong or you want to check up to confirm that nothing is wrong. So that's really the medical side of the coin. The public health side is concerned with everything that goes right. It's really about creating the conditions for good health. So things like running water, sanitation, where when you flush the toilet, the waste is safely taken away, clean food, access to vaccines, all of those are elements of the public health system that we don't think about a lot because they are so deeply woven in the fabric of our lives and communities, and yet they are responsible for so much of the good health that we enjoy. And that's really what drew me to the field when I first started thinking about becoming a public health practitioner. Is just how much it means to keep people well and what that can spare them from, the kinds of troubles that can protect people from. And I think it's really powerful to think about keeping people well, and it's something that I'm proud to be a part of.
I really appreciate you highlighting kind of food and water as those basic components of it. And you talk about that a little bit in your book about how kind of clean sanitation, beginning of those, making sure that we've got access to these basic fundamentals. In Alaska, that's particularly important, and, you know, encourage Alaskans to consider calling in and sharing your stories. But, you know, we have many communities in the state that don't have access to clean water and sewer, and that continues to be a huge challenge in this state, not in our urban areas in the same sort of way, but in our rural areas. With public health being so much the quiet cousin, and it's become a little bit louder since COVID and people are much more aware of it, but when you were choosing this field, it was very much a quiet cousin because of many of the successes. What made you choose the field of public health? How did you know about it?
It's funny. I have always wanted to be an epidemiologist, which is a very specific career, and I do not know how I came to this idea. I certainly did not know any other epidemiologists, but for some reason, it just entered my head that this is something I would like to do. And of course, when you develop an interest, I think it's natural to start to look into it more, wonder about it, crave a better understanding of it. And so I remember very clearly the book Mountains Beyond Mountains was very influential to me. This is a book that is a biography of Dr. Paul Farmer, a physician and anthropologist who really dedicated his life to bringing public health and medicine to some of the poorest communities in the world. And I was really touched by the dedication that he brought to his work and the way that he changed so many lives through really focusing on what was needed to keep people well. And so I think having that example of Paul Farmer and really being able to dive into his biography and see in such clear illustration what it means to devote a life to public health was very motivating for me. And so I really attribute that as the moment that crystallized for me that epidemiology is something that could be really fulfilling.
Awesome. As many listeners know, on the website, we do list different podcasts and books, and we'll go ahead and add that one as well to make sure that people have access to the recommendation. I'm getting more and more questions from students who are interested in public health now kind of post-COVID and want to hear different stories in that space. So let's fast forward a little bit. You became very well known during COVID working at Johns Hopkins. I think many of us remember that bright red dashboard in many ways that became more and more red each day. You became very prolific on multiple podcasts and shows and really helping to communicate the science of what we knew and what we didn't know. Tell me a little bit about your journey into public health communication and sharing the stories of what we knew from infectious disease epidemiology in your time and through COVID and beyond.
It was something of an accident that I took up the mantle of public health communicator, and I think it really arose out of my lifelong interest in reading and writing. I have dedicated almost all my free time, it feels like, of which there is less now than there was before I had kids, but I love to read and I love to write, and that taught me a lot about telling stories and making difficult concepts accessible, reaching people and really connecting with them. And so I semi-naturally brought those kind of skills and observations to the work of public health communication. But so much of it was just about responding to the moment, because I am an epidemiologist specializing in epidemics and pandemics. There was great demand, I think, to hear from people who could explain what was going on and provide clearly expressed perspectives. And so that is more or less how I tumbled into the work. But as time has passed, I've really grown to appreciate this aspect of my career, speaking with the public, appearing on podcasts and radio shows, writing for public audiences. It's not a traditional part of academic careers. I'm a professor, and mostly we focus on doing research. But the more that I've done it, the more I've seen the impact that I make in doing communication is as big, if not bigger, than the work I do in my research. And so now I see it as indispensable, and I'm very proud to devote as much time as I can, really, to public health communications.
Well, we really appreciate you taking the time to join us for today's communication on Line One, Your Health Connection. As I was mentioning to you before the show, you know, I read your book, really was thinking a lot about the stories and the work, but while I was re-listening to part of it on the way in today, I was reminded of what a great storyteller you are. And you share personal stories in the book. You also share a lot of just fascinating stories about not only infectious disease epidemiology, but about communication. Would you mind sharing a story with our audience about what either surprised you the most or one of the most interesting stories that you learned of or really just really wanted to share about public health when you thought about writing this book? What was the story that you're like, I got to get this out?
So many, but one that really sticks out for me is the story of adenovirus in the military. And listeners may not have heard of adenovirus. It mostly causes the common cold. You've almost certainly had it, even if you didn't know that you had it. Things like sore throat, the sniffles, maybe a low-grade fever. That's how most people experience adenovirus. But in the military, it's actually a very serious problem because people who are entering basic training, for example, they live in close quarters in the barracks. They may be physically exhausted, have access to poor nutrition or on and off access to adequate nutrition. And all of that makes them very susceptible to adenovirus. And this was of particular interest to me because I used to be an Army epidemiologist. I was a civilian. I was not in uniform, but I was responsible, one of the people responsible for protecting public health for service members and their families. And in that role, I was the acute respiratory disease surveillance program manager, which basically meant that I was in charge of overseeing adenovirus. And one of the fascinating stories about the history of adenovirus in the military is there had been a vaccine to protect troops for decades, and it worked very well. And it transformed adenovirus from something that would absolutely flatten basic training classes and put dozens of people in the hospital into just a normal kind of cold-like illness like those of us in the community, not as part of the military, would experience it. But then, for reasons that are even now sort of beyond understanding, the vaccine was stopped. And it was really a bureaucratic administration failure. The contract was not kept up to date. Actions weren't taken. Things weren't signed that would keep the vaccine supply flowing. And it ended. And immediately, as soon as the vaccine supply ended, there was a huge flare of outbreaks of adenovirus in the barracks, just as there had been in the 1950s when the vaccine was first invented and distributed. And for me, that story really illustrates how comfortable we can be in public health with things going right. For decades, we had this vaccine, it worked, we sort of forgot about adenovirus in the military. And through that experience, we kind of lost interest, or at least lost commitment in maintaining the very thing that was keeping the situation quiet. And so, of course, as soon as the virus resurged and the outbreaks came back, then that was a clear enough reminder of why the vaccine was important. And the military went to great expense to pay a new manufacturer to begin the vaccine. But it took about a decade for all of that to be arranged. And in that time, about 8 young lives were lost, 8 people who had, young men in their not even 20, who had reached, and women who had joined the military, lost their lives to this preventable disease. And that is what we call the cycle of panic and neglect. It's the rise and fall of interest and commitment in reaction to the fact that when public health is working, things are quiet and nothing is happening. And that's exactly the way we want it.
Yeah, I had not actually heard that story or knew that history of adenovirus until I read your book. You know, Alaska has the highest rates of veterans per capita as well as active military per capita. Amazing men and women service throughout our state. And I was just working with someone in the military last night on my shift, and we were talking about just that specific example that was there. I think that one of the things that's always amazed me is, you know, working in public health or healthcare, you see when crises happen and so raise concerns and awareness about why we need to help prevent them and how to be able to keep that attention there. But it can be hard to do. So besides telling these stories, what ways, you know, can Alaskans, can other military members, can physicians help to make sure that we're not creating fear or paranoia on a regular basis, saying, well, this disease might get you or that disease might get you, but also making sure that we're paying attention to prevention to stay healthy and well? You know, what lessons did you learn from that story or others in making sure that we're paying attention to averting crisis?
Yeah, I do think telling stories is such a powerful way to remind people of what's important and the history, how we got here, why we got to this place. And there hasn't been as much of a tradition of storytelling in public health as there have been in medicine, for example, where there's lots of columnists in major newspapers and books, narrative nonfiction books describing the medicine from the inside. We haven't had so much of that in public health, and that's part of what I wanted to do with my book. And so that's something that I would like to see more in the field. The other thing I would say is keeping up a regular communication with the public, I think, is really important. Historically, public health often only has opportunities to speak with the public when there's something to announce, right? There is an outbreak or there is a new vaccine or some sort of event. But in only bridging that gap and making that relationship and really speaking to people when there is a big announcement, it's really a cold start. It's difficult to come in with trust and respect and mutual understanding if it's the first time you've ever had a conversation. And so I think these kinds of weekly radio, monthly radio shows, or regular columns in newspapers, or segments on TV where the public can really get to know public health professionals is another way that we can keep up the conversation and make those quiet successes more visible.
Yeah, you know, another story that I think about, particularly with the military and that you highlight in your book, is smallpox and a lot of the success associated with smallpox. And our active military are still immunized against smallpox, even though it is still there. Would you talk a little bit about the successes of smallpox, as well as who is immunized against it right now, what we need to know about it, and kind of the advent of vaccination and the smallpox efforts as a whole? Because it's, I think, a fascinating story.
The eradication of smallpox is, in my opinion, one of humanity's greatest achievements. Smallpox was an absolute terror. In communities that had not had smallpox circulating regularly, it affected basically everyone. It was very easily spread from person to person, and it had a mortality rate that is basically unheard of today. Something like a third of people infected with smallpox would die. Even among the people who survived, they would experience often lifelong scarring of the skin, blindness. There were many long-term consequences of infection, even among survivors. The flip side is that smallpox was the first virus for which humanity developed a vaccine, and immediately put it to work by protecting people from this terrible scourge and really trying to slow down transmission. And eventually this culminated in the idea in the first half of the 20th century to eradicate smallpox. And eradicate means completely stop transmission everywhere in the world such that the virus no longer exists. And it took about, let's say, 30 years of working to immunize or to vaccinate everyone in the world in order for the virus to be stopped. And there were some highs and lows, some different strategies of how epidemiologists got that done. But what's remarkable to me about the story or the lesson of smallpox, there are a few. The first is that humanity had a shared vision. Literally every country in the world bought into this vision of stopping the virus from circulating altogether. Second, the logistics of reaching almost everyone in the world with the vaccine and keeping that up for years and years, all in service of stopping this virus. And third, the amazing gift that those epidemiologists and those public health professionals from the first half of the 20th century gave us in achieving that amazing success in banishing smallpox. There has not been a case since 1977. And so there are now generations of people who have never experienced this virus and will never experience this virus. And I think that's enormously powerful and inspirational. And I think really speaks to the kinds of successes and miracles that that public health can secure. There are some people who still get vaccinated against smallpox because there are perennial concerns that it could be used as a weapon. There could be some sort of deliberate attempt to reintroduce smallpox. And so some military members are vaccinated against smallpox. And a related virus, Mpox, is circulating at low levels now in the United States. It's much less deadly, but it's nonetheless a relative of smallpox. And so people who are at risk of Mpox also are receiving the vaccine that also protects against smallpox.
Great. I think it's just a fascinating story. And I think one of the other things that I would highlight in it is the fact it's an example of where we no longer recommend to the general public a vaccination. Oftentimes we hear these comments, oh, there's just more and more and more. But that's a great example of where, as you mentioned, there's no more smallpox circulating. And as a result, it's not a general recommended vaccine because everything does have side effects. And in general, less is more. And when there's no longer a threat, there's no longer that need for protection in the same sort of way. And so it's the reason why many of us have never been vaccinated against it, and a great success in the fact that it's not just additive. Once the disease or the threat is no longer there, then it's no longer needed. So it's a remarkable public health success, and I would totally agree with that. For those of us just joining us, we are on Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm Dr. Ann Zink, and I am joined with Dr. Caitlin Rivers, epidemiologist from Johns Hopkins, who just put out her first book called Crisis Averted, The Hidden Science of Outbreaks. I would encourage Alaskans, if you've got any questions about communication, public health, prevention. In her book, she also highlights some healthcare prevention as well. Her real focus is on infectious disease epidemiology, but there's some highlights in the book as well about healthcare prevention. We'd love to hear from you and from your stories about what prevention looks like in your community and what sort of stories or those magic threads you have seen. You can join the conversation in Anchorage at 907-550-8433 or statewide at 1-888-353-5752. And you can also email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. We're going to go ahead and take a quick break, and we will come back here shortly with Dr. Caitlin Rivers.
You're listening to Line One from Alaska Public Media. You can find Line One on alaskapublic.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Get your weekly look at the trends, policies, and issues that impact your wallet in Alaska with the Alaska Economic Report. From local businesses to fiscal policy to big industries like fishing, tourism, and oil and gas, I'll cover the high-stakes economic issues that matter to Alaskans all over the state. That's the Alaska Economic Report with me, Ava White, on your local public radio station each week.
Today's episode of Line One, Your Health Connection, is a rebroadcast of a previous episode. We will not be taking phone calls or emails during today's program.
Welcome back to Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm Dr. Ann Zink, and today we're honored to have Dr. Caitlin Rivers join us. She's a Johns Hopkins epidemiologist and author of the recently published book, Crisis Averted, The Hidden Science of Fighting Outbreaks. On the second segment, I would love to talk a little bit more, not just about communication, but also bring in some of healthcare. And Dr. Rivers, one of my favorite parts about your book was not using the word tornado. I actually met Dr. Rivers when we were at a Center for Forecasting and Analytics meeting when that center was first being launched, and talking a lot about the ways that we communicate risk to the general public for things like weather and what ways we can do better to use data to help communicate risk to the public as a whole. You know, one of the things that has always been a real focus to me is data democratization, making sure that people have the data and information in your hands to make the best information and decisions for you. It's one thing when I'm sitting side by side with my patient giving them information, which is very different than speaking here or to the state or to the nation about how to think about risk and benefit as a whole, and getting people that information is there. The weather forecasting system has done amazing work to take information and data and things that are completely not visible or tangible and making them real. I was just checking out the weather forecast around the world the other night, and it's amazing the data information that's in my hand or on my app. Can you tell us a little bit about the beginning of the weather forecasting, about communication and words that could or could not be used, and how that changed, and how you think that applies to public health and getting information out to the public?
It is a fascinating story and one of my favorite parts in researching my book. In the first half of the 20th century, all the way through the 1940s, I would say, it was actually against the rules for weather forecasters to warn of tornadoes. They could warn of high winds or severe storms, but it was against their policy to use the word tornado. And the justifications given for why this word was meant to be forbidden resonate, unfortunately, with some of what I hear in public health. Some of the justifications were that it would cause panic to warn of tornadoes, that it would cause the stoppage of business, and even that the secondary effects of taking shelter could be harmful. So there was one person who was concerned that sheltering in a basement, it would be damp down there, and that would cause health effects that were somehow worse than getting hit by a tornado. And so this policy was really in place out of fears of how the public would emotionally experience or react to the warning, and not the way that we think about it now, if we fast forward 70 years, which is an orientation towards thinking about what does the public need to do with this information, and how can we give them the best resources to understand and act. So now, here in 2024, the National Weather Service has a whole group of social scientists who test messages about the weather so that the public can best understand them. So even in the course of my lifespan, it used to be that weather warnings would say things like barometric pressure is dropping. And I don't know what that means. I don't know how to interpret that. But if you look now, weather warnings say things like small trees will be uprooted and flying objects will break glass. And that transformation is really in service of making sure that everyone can understand the severity of the storm and therefore take appropriate action. What I see sometimes in public health is reminds me of those early days of tornado forecasting where there's a reluctance to really name the threat, to speak about it clearly, and to really see the public as partners in disease prevention. In the early days of the COVID-19 pandemic, for example, we heard a lot from our national leaders that the risk to the American public is low. And it may have been low in that exact second. January of 2020, the risk in a literal sense was in fact low. But it was pretty clear, to me at least, in those early days, that the virus was coming and that it would be very disruptive and very dangerous. And I think it was a missed opportunity not to explain that more clearly to the public and really bring them along or engage, start a national conversation about what it would mean for this novel coronavirus to reach our shores. And so I'd really like to see the field evolve towards being more truthful and more transparent and more comprehensive in our communications, because it really is each of us as individuals who need to take action. And so, of course, we need the best information in order to do that well.
Yeah, I really appreciate that story. And I also really liked how the fact that it highlighted that things can change. You know, the weather can be good and then it can get bad. Whereas you were mentioning the risk in January of 2020 was very different than it was in December of 2021. Or today when I was driving in South Central Alaska and it's rainy and icy on the roads, it's very different than it was in July. And so what ways can we use experiences that we have on a regular basis? Again, encouraging Alaskans to consider calling in. You know, we love to hear about what information you would want to hear from or not want to hear. The state of Alaska has put out a weekly forecasting for COVID, RSV, and influenza. And in fact, last night used it in the emergency department to understand better, should we be doing flu testing or not? So along those lines, you know, one question that had come in previously on social media that I just wanted to bring up, and this gets a little bit into forecasting what we know, is what do you really make of the H5N1 California wastewater data? Help us understand how you're thinking about that, what data we know, and what you would share with the public about that.
Sure. So for those who haven't been following along with this recent event, H5N1 is a type of influenza that has been circulating first in wild birds and then in the last year or so in dairy cattle. This is not an influenza that spreads from person to person right now, but epidemiologists like me are afraid that it will gain the ability to spread from person to person. One reason that this is particularly concerning as a possible scenario is that influenza has always been at the top of the list of possible pandemic pathogens. We know it has caused, it being influenza, has caused pandemics in the past. And so, of course, the fear is always that it will come back. And I think H5N1 creeping closer and closer to the human population is one way that that those fears are top of mind, at least for me right now. What the listener who contributed that question is referring to is widespread detection of H5N1 in wastewater. So looking at wastewater to see if the virus is present, a lot of sites in California currently have positive detections. At the same time, a lot of dairy cattle in California are positive. There are many herds that are positive. And so what the most likely explanation is in my mind is the runoff or the contributions from the infected cattle are entering the wastewater and therefore we're seeing positives for that reason. But I don't think we can rule out the possibility that there are human infections, because we do know that farmers in particular have been becoming infected with H5N1 because of their interaction with animals. And of course, just as a reminder, the fear being that the virus will gain the ability to spread from human to human, I think we also need to be looking more closely at the human population continuously just to make sure that the virus is not circulating undetected there.
Great. Thank you for highlighting that. And for our listeners, you know, we were fortunate to have Dr. Jay Butler last month, and he talks a lot about the history and what we know as well. So I'd refer people back to that podcast. We did get an email from Douglas, and he said, here's my story. Vaccinate, vaccinate, vaccinate. I have a weak immune system. I had COVID twice, but each time it was mild, which I attribute to keeping up with vaccination. Meanwhile, my neighbor with a vigorous immune system died from COVID vaccinate. You know, this is a story and this is his story. And, you know, I'm really glad to hear that you are doing well, Douglas. And we really try to balance with the risk and benefit and different people's immune systems and sharing out those stories as a whole. What other kind of, when your family asks you, do I really need to get another flu vaccine? When my 16-year-old looks at me and says, I don't want another shot. I'll never forget when my first kiddo was a, you know, little tiny baby and I brought her to her pediatrician and seeing those needles go into her cute little thigh. It was heartbreaking as a parent. And it's really hard to ask people to do something that could potentially put your kiddo at risk or you at risk or even just hurts them, like puts a needle in them. Or when you feel really miserable getting after vaccination, it's kind of a discongruity and a challenge to overcome that. As a healthcare provider, in some ways, it's easier because I get to see, unfortunately, the really awful side effects of when people don't get the opportunity to take preventative measures. So what stories or what sort of information would you share? I would also highlight the fact that in your book, you talk a lot about public health is population health, but behind each of it is a story, and this is Douglas' story. What other stories would you share in that space?
Yeah, that's right. I have three young children myself, and they loathe getting vaccinated as much as any child does. But we do our annual flu vaccine, our annual COVID vaccine, and follow the childhood vaccination schedule. Because similar to you, Dr. Zink, as an epidemiologist, I'm well aware of what the consequences are of not being protected against pathogens that for most of human history had the potential to be fatal. Many people regard influenza, for example, as a mild illness. And for many people it is. You get it, you feel miserable for a week and you recover. But every year there are hundreds of children, or 100, I won't say hundreds, but between 100 and 200 children here in the United States who die of influenza. And that's not a chance that I'm willing to take with my kids. I would also highlight that just in the last, this is the second season, there are now products available for older adults, for pregnant women, and for infants to protect against RSV. And RSV is one of those pathogens that can be very dangerous for older adults and for infants. And I think it's really remarkable that we now have options to protect people from severe illness. And so I think that that's the kind of advance that we see in public health that can really change the experience of parents from having to be extra cautious during the holiday season and visiting the doctor or maybe even visiting the hospital with a baby who can't breathe well because they have RSV, to now having options to protect them. And those are the stories that I think really remind me why we're so lucky to have these vaccines as options.
Yeah, I appreciate you highlighting that. And Dr. Ellen Rogers talked about on our last podcast the high rates of RSV out in the Bethel region and really what a game changer it is to have a monoclonal antibody that can be protective as well as a vaccine during pregnancy. We do have a live caller in who is calling from Anchorage. Bill has a question regarding blood types and COVID. Bill, you're on the air.
Oh, first of all, thank you both for being there. Caitlin, I've been just subscribing to your email letter for quite a while. Give me a lot of hope, as did the host you're talking to, Dr. Zink, during COVID. It really helped a lot. I read a thing the other day about O positive and COVID, that people who have O positive blood have a different reaction, and they didn't find as much long-term COVID with that. I'll take it off the air. I was just wondering if you knew anything about blood types and different infections. Thank you.
Thanks for calling in, Bill. Dr. Rivers, what do you have to say about blood types and COVID?
This is not something I've heard about. I'll give it a little look after we end here today because I'm curious, but I'm not aware of any impact of blood type on COVID outcomes. But Dr. Zink, I'm wondering if you have any other information.
Yeah, I have reviewed some early and preliminary data that does look like there may be some different outcomes on blood type. I'm not an epidemiologist, nor am I a hepatologist. I'm an emergency doctor. One of the things that I've actually struggled with blood type a little bit is it's just not something that's changeable, right? Like our blood type is our blood type. And so it's not a modifiable risk condition. And so a lot of what I focus on is what do we have that is modifiable or not, like keeping yourself away or helping to get vaccinated. But as Bill mentioned, if we do see data that shows that certain people are at higher risk based on blood type or not, just like certain people are at higher risk versus age or not, that can be really, really helpful to the individual. So appreciate you bringing that up. I also would highlight, Bill had mentioned Dr. Rivers' regular newsletter, and there's always little pearls and tidbits in there as well. So, Bill, appreciate you bringing that up. We do have another comment from social media. It was kind of a longer one. I'll paraphrase it from Roy Jones on Facebook. And he, you know, had a lot of concerns about vaccination, about communication as a whole. He talked about pharmaceutical puppet masters and big pharma being involved, feeling like lied to and propaganda. Help us understand a little bit about the role of pharmaceutical involvement with vaccination, payment. You know, help us understand the concerns regarding pharmaceuticals and vaccinations and, you know, understandable real fear about mistrust, about being lied to, about consequences related to large corporations and ulterior motives. What do you say to patients or to the public when they ask you those questions?
There are a lot of variations on these questions. The one that I hear probably most often is concern that the data demonstrating that the COVID-19 vaccines are safe and effective isn't true or isn't reflective of reality in some way because it's been so lucrative for the pharmaceutical companies who developed and provide the vaccines to have them widely available and to have so many people vaccinated. In response to that, I would say that there are so many steps in the process of bringing a vaccine to market where there are checks and balances and independent scientists reviewing the data that I don't have any concern that the books have been cooked in any kind of way. Just to give you a sense, right now in the political media, there's been a lot of discussion of FDA being untrustworthy for some reason, in some way, FDA being the Food and Drug Administration, because of the interaction with pharmaceutical companies in the course of their work, or because some FDA regulators, after they retire or after they leave their job, join the pharmaceutical industry, those concerns kind of contribute to skepticism about whether or not they're truly independent. But one feature of the vaccine safety system that I think is really important is that on both the FDA side and the CDC side, it's actually a group of independent experts who reviews the evidence and makes recommendations about whether a vaccine is truly safe and effective. Those independent experts are not federal employees. They are required to fill out lengthy conflict of interest disclosures, and all of the proceedings, all of the meetings, all of the data and slides that they review, all of that is public. And so there is a lot of independence and a lot of transparency built into the process that gives me, as an independent expert, a great deal of confidence that the products that make it to market truly are safe and effective.
Yeah, I appreciate you bringing that up. And we were lucky enough to have Dr. Dale again on a podcast, and he sat on the ACIP committee. And it was great to hear him talk about his experience. And I know as a state health official, I was not paid by pharmaceuticals. I was paid by the state to just provide information. But it can be scary and overwhelming. And so I really do appreciate people asking hard questions. And information and science and data changes. Going back a little bit to the conversations that we had about farm animals, just to jump all around, we have another question. I appreciate Donna emailing in. And she said her question is, for farm animal runoff, especially on commercial farms, this has caused problems for adjoining vegetable farms. What about, here she says, H1 and 2 runoff. She might mean H1 and 5, but runoff affecting and or spreading to food supply. So talk a little bit about what we know with viruses and food supply and runoff.
There is no significant, I'm not concerned that H5N1 is going to enter the food supply, with one serious exception, which is raw dairy products. Raw milk, for example, the virus has been found in raw milk products and is not safe to drink. And so I really highly recommend pasteurization, the regular milk products that you buy on the shelf that have been pasteurized. Those are all completely safe, but raw milk products are likely are very, very likely to have H5N1 if they come from an infected herd. Whether or not that is capable of infecting a human, we don't quite know, that we haven't collected evidence on that yet, but I would certainly err on the side of pasteurization. I have not seen any data or evidence to suggest that vegetable farms that are adjacent to dairies, for example, are at risk. And so my personal fear about that is low, but washing ought to take care of any residual contaminants just in case that's something that feels worth doing for you.
I appreciate that. And not just H5N1, but part of the reason for recommendation of pasteurization is because of a whole bunch of pathogens in general. So that's why pasteurization is recommended. Bacteria can be amazingly good for your gut, and things like yogurt can provide really great sources for that. But raw milk definitely has a risk to it, and appreciate you highlighting that fact. We are getting up on our next segment and want to kind of move to our break, but I just wanted to highlight to Alaskans that you're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection. This is Dr. Ann Zink, and after the break, we'd love to hear your perspective on prevention. We've talked a lot about public health, but we'll be talking a little bit more about healthcare prevention in this last segment, as well as what stories and lessons have been learned from Alaska Native population or others around the state. You can join us in the conversation in Anchorage at 907-550-8433 or statewide at 1-888-353-5752 or email us at line1@alaskapublic.org.
You're listening to Line One from Alaska Public Media. You can find Line One on alaskapublic.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Start your day with a quick look at the most important stories from around the state with Alaska Morning News, your dose of headlines each weekday morning. With reporters covering every corner of Alaska, you can be sure you're up to date on the stories that matter to Alaskans. Join me, Ava White, for Alaska Morning News, weekdays on your local public radio station.
Today's episode of Line One, Your Health Connection, is a rebroadcast of a previous episode. We will not be taking phone calls or emails during today's program.
Welcome back to Line One, Your Health Connection. This is your host, Dr. Ann Zink, and I am honored to be joined today with Dr. Caitlin Rivers, Johns Hopkins epidemiologist and author of a recently published book, which I'd highly encourage taking a look at, Crisis Averted, The Hidden Science of Fighting Outbreaks. It's great to have conversations with Alaskans and others. There was a question that came up earlier from Bill in Anchorage about blood type, which we did get a chance to just double check during our break with a new article that did recently get published from JAMA showing an association. So we'll go ahead and put that article in our link notes as well. That is the great thing about science. It's one of my favorite things that we had during COVID, where we had those weekly Zoom calls, which some of you attended, where I got to learn from the public. I got to learn from policymakers, and I got to learn from whole teams of additional people in real time. So we'll go ahead and put that up on our website as well. We have another question here from Mark, and it says that it seems to me during the pandemic, the term vaccine and vaccination have become interchangeable, both in spoken and print press. Do the guests think that this interferes with accurate communication to the public? Mark, I appreciate highlighting kind of the need to be accurate about the difference between vaccine and vaccination. Dr. Rivers, how would you respond to that?
Well, one thing that comes to mind for me is a phrase we use a lot in public health, which is that a vaccine is not a vaccination. And what we mean by that is just because a product is available, just because there is a vaccine on the market, does not equate to shots in arms. There is a lot of work that public health professionals and medical professionals have to do to reach people, to help them afford it, to talk about their concerns, and to really get someone immunized. And so that, for me, is the difference between a vaccine and a vaccination. The mere existence of a vaccine does not mean that someone is protected. But Dr. Zink, what comes up for you when you hear about the difference between vaccine and vaccination?
Yeah, no, I hear the same component. You know, it's not going to do anything if it's sitting in the vial, but it's going to do something if it really stimulates the immune system to creating a strong and robust response. You know, you highlight the important work of public health in that space, but I would also highlight the data to show that individual conversations between family and friends is the single most important thing that people were using to decide if they were going to go ahead and get vaccinated. And that's part of the reason why we spend time in this respiratory season talking with Alaskans, is because you all listening may be the most influential people in helping to improve the health and well-being of your community, supported by public health, and talking about those stories out there. The other thing this brings to mind is the many comments that I got. Well, it's not a shot. The flu shot is a shot versus a vaccination, something that goes in the nose. Many different conversations that we have about what a vaccination is. Maybe we could just talk just briefly about what a vaccination is and the different ways that they can be administered, because they don't all have to be a shot.
Yeah, that's right. This year, I was very curious, but I wasn't able to get it in the end, the FluMist product. So you can actually get immunized against influenza with a spray up your nose. It was hard to find in my area. I hope that's not true for you, but that is a product that is on the market and spares you the shot if that is something that is of interest. Most vaccinations that you get will be the shot in the arm, which can hurt a little bit and can be sore the next day. That's the most common method. But there are also some less common ones like subcutaneous injections that just go barely under the skin. If you get an Mpox vaccine, that might be the way that you receive it. So there are various modalities, but the most common one is the shot in the arm.
Another one that I've been hearing a lot about in the news has been polio. And there's a difference between an oral polio vaccine versus shot, and they have different risk profiles. And we've been seeing some of the components. Maybe would you just spend a few minutes talking about the different polio vaccines?
Yeah, sure. The polio vaccine that most people get is a few drops in the mouth, and that protects the GI system, which is where polio enters the body. It's a fecal oral waterborne disease. That did not come to mind for me, but that's right. The polio vaccine and some of the cholera vaccines are also oral. One of the less common approaches to vaccination, but definitely one of the most pleasant, I guess. Also the adenovirus vaccine, which I spoke about earlier, is a pill. And so there are different types of approaches that can be more or less pleasant, but are all important for protection.
Great. Awesome. You know, we've gotten the opportunity, which totally makes sense as an infectious disease epidemiologist focusing on infectious disease. But you start your story off talking about your absolutely adorable twin girls, which I hear are five now and getting big. And the story is terrifying and scary, but also it's so great to hear a good outcome. And there's much that happens in healthcare. And as you mentioned in your book, there's much more to public health than just infectious disease epidemiology. So what are some stories that you would highlight in kind of the healthcare or non-infectious disease world where you have really seen successes with prevention or would want to highlight?
Yeah, our medical colleagues, doctors, nurses, nurse practitioners, PAs, all of them are so important for helping to connect patients to the kinds of resources that keep them healthy, whether it's a vaccine, whether it's a medication that prevents the progression of an illness, whether it's highlighting that someone is vulnerable and could use a little extra help with getting connected to food stamps, for example, to SNAP benefits or to housing support. It's really the medical side of the house that is the interface between most people and better health. There are many more medical providers than there are public health professionals, and so it's definitely a super important component of our health system. One thing we don't have a lot of in the United States, but that most of the rest of the world relies upon, is community health workers. And so what I see a lot, and I believe this to be true in Alaska as well, are informal community health workers who have some knowledge. Maybe they're retired, maybe it's a special interest of theirs, but really take it upon themselves to be that resource for people who need conversations, who need ideas, who need resources about how to reach better health. And so I do want to raise up and acknowledge those people as being really important parts of our system as well, even if informal.
Yeah, I appreciate you highlighting that and, you know, talking about the ways that we're connected to individuals and how much stories make a difference. You know, I'd also just want to highlight for the Alaska public the importance of preventative healthcare work. There's reasons for those recommendations. Unfortunately, Alaskans and particularly Alaska Natives have some of the highest rates of colon cancer in the world. And getting that colonoscopy starting at age 40 for Alaska Natives and 45 is an incredibly important preventative measure tool that actually the Division of Public Health helps to get information out and about and awareness for and can prevent severe disease. Good friend recently went for his screening colonoscopy and found to have pretty advanced colon cancer, but the ability to catch it early was the ability to make sure it didn't spread and move other places. So while we have focused a lot today on infectious disease epidemiology, just really highlighting the fact that prevention can come in all sorts of forms, be it screening exams, be it clean food and water, as Dr. Rivers had mentioned earlier, let alone vaccination or helping to keep you safe and healthy and well. You know, part of the reason I really enjoyed your book and wanted to have you on again was those stories. And I often told other state health officials that the greatest gift I was given during my time was getting to work with Alaska Native people and hearing their stories and hearing about the 1918 pandemic, which was often referred to as the Great Death. And those stories were shared and told amongst community members and shared with us really early on as policymakers about the efforts that were taken to help reduce the risk of spread early on at the beginning of the turn of the century when we were just learning about even what viruses were, let alone what this was. You know, like the village of Shishmaref keeping people out at gunpoint and not allowing people in and really keeping the virus out versus other communities that had the virus come in via seafood processing and mail, and then you started to see the virus take off quite early. What other historical context would you give us for thinking about the ways that people move between communities, the ways that viruses have spread, viruses, infectious diseases have been with us since the dawn of time, and that takes a different history and role? And you have some of those stories in your book. Help us think about how what stories history has taught us to think about vaccination, infectious disease, or averting crises.
There are so many, and the ones that really come to mind for me center the heroism and the dedication of epidemiologists. One thing I really wanted to do in my book is bring to light or put a spotlight on people who very often are behind the scenes. And so there is one story I like from the smallpox eradication campaign. This story dates to the 1960s or the 1970s, when a team of eradicators loaded up a Jeep with all of the supplies they would need for several weeks of self-sufficiency and their smallpox vaccines, and they set across rural Sudan, which at the time was experiencing conflict, for the goal of finding as many people as possible and vaccinating them. And so just to highlight again, they took upon themselves enormous adventure, I guess, if you're putting a positive spin on it, but also enormous danger to travel a country that was experiencing war, that what did not have provisions, did not have spare tires or food should you run out or clean water. And it was all in service of making sure that people could be vaccinated. And I think that for me, this really emphasizes just how dedicated public health professionals can be and the kinds of lengths they'll go to protect their communities. And also how much vaccination against smallpox meant to the world, to every country in the world, that was seen as worth it and valuable and appreciated. And I think that because we now enjoy a time of relative calm in the sense that we don't have infants dying of preventable diseases like we did at the turn of the century, and we don't have smallpox anymore, I think we've forgotten a little bit how much infectious diseases used to threaten us and the kinds of lengths and kinds of dedication that were required to keep them at bay. And that kind of story really reminds me of how things used to be and how grateful I am that we live here today where we do have those resources and those benefits.
Yeah, and there's some amazing stories in the smallpox vaccination era that kept me going for a lot of time and thinking about different creative ways to move forward. You know, in that, there's also, as diseases decrease, as we live in a different era, there is an increasing need to make sure that vaccines are incredibly safe. You know, it's one of the few things that we recommend to give to totally healthy people. It's one thing when you're sick and you feel miserable that you want that antibiotic or you want that thing that's going to make you feel better. But when you feel well, it's harder to choose prevention in the same sort of way. So if we look forward, you know, there's a lot of conversations about vaccine safety, about efficacy. When we think about changing administrations, when we think about the ways that we can use data, and I know that you've been a data scientist and think a lot about data, what do you hope that we're able to do looking forward to make sure that we've got the data that we need, that we're able to make sure that vaccines are as safe as effective, and that we also have transparency about emerging diseases? What's your crystal ball? Or if you were a king or queen queen of the world for the day, what would you want to see happen?
Yeah, as you mentioned, Dr. Zink, I think the more data and analyses, the better. The pathway to get a candidate vaccine or a vaccine that is still being developed to market is very clearly defined and leverages a lot of data and is very, the analyses are very well prescribed. It's all very clear. Post-market, there are still a lot of surveillance systems. And that is to say, after a vaccine comes on the market and people begin receiving it, there are still several layers of surveillance systems that look for adverse effects. But I think the gap that I'm seeing is that data is available, but not easily interpretable. So you can actually go online and look at all of the adverse event reports that have been submitted, but you kind of have to curate them a little bit, right? And I think what would help people to feel more comfortable, or this is a hypothesis of mine, is to be able to see more kind of analyses or more confirmation, more ongoing looks at vaccine safety. That's one thing that comes to mind for me. But there are also so many innovations in medical technology, in medical data, in AI, that I suspect that there are a lot of innovations that I can't even imagine right now that will be coming around the corner in the next 5, 10, 15 years that will change what we can do around disease surveillance and vaccine safety and really everything related to public health. So I'm also trying to keep an open mind and trying to be creative about all of the ways our future will change.
Yeah, it is pretty exciting to think about the ways. And again, in my world of working between this healthcare world and public health world, I would love to see more de-identified healthcare data being available to public health specialists like our epidemiologists to see trends, everything from hemoglobin A1C to see what the diabetes rates are so that we can have better interventions to being able to see influenza-like infections that are coming out so that we're able to move forward. So I'm excited to think about the ways that we can better braid public health and healthcare data in a de-identified way, and in much that we do, we talked about weather data so that specialists can give us recommendations and help to interpret it, but individuals can also make those decisions for themselves. You talk a little bit in your book about AI, and as I first got to know you via technology and forecasting, tell me a little bit how you see, you mentioned it briefly, but how technology may or may not disrupt the field of public health and healthcare coming up.
Well, my hope is that it continues to democratize it. I think one of the great things about public health is that it is meant to reach everyone and protect everyone. And I think, well, I don't know, right? But I think that AI may be one of the tools that can help to further democratize a field that is already very much meant to benefit everyone. Approach that I've used in my own life is more on the medical side, but I have found AI tools to be really great for helping me to understand test results and diagnoses and symptoms so that I can have more confident conversations with my doctors about, you know, what I'm experiencing or what they're experiencing. It can really help as an education tool. Now, I'm sure very prudently that experts would warn that AI is not a doctor, and I don't mean to suggest that it is. But, you know, as a patient, it's very helpful for getting me up to speed about things that are otherwise, the conversations you have with a doctor can move very quickly, and you may have a lot more questions than you're able to bring out. And so I really appreciate that as a tool, and I could imagine that it could assist people with public health questions in the same way.
I totally agree. As a doctor, I love it when people Google their symptoms beforehand. Honestly, I do, or ChatGPT, because they come in with their concerns, their questions, they come in informed, and I can help go through what they see and don't put it into context, but it really forwards the conversation. So I really love your comment about democratization of information so that people can be informed. Speaking of, we have another caller, Todd from Anchorage, has a question about polio causing mutations. Todd, you're on the air.
Hello, thank you for the program, and I'm an internal medicine doc and really appreciate the topic. I was pleased that you brought up polio because the oral, I assume it's still true, the oral vaccine is live attenuated virus, and I am aware of reports in areas of the world where the sewage system has gotten a lot of these viruses in them from the guts, and then they've mutated to become virulent again, and then I don't hear much about it. I'm wondering, is that going on a lot with polio and or other things, and how's the perspective public health-wise on that?
Yeah, Todd, I appreciate the question, and we're just running against time, and so apologize for the late, but Dr. Rivers, a quick answer, because it's a really important topic.
The polio virus polio vaccine, rather, can result in live virus being shed in the stool and entering the water supply. This is an attenuated virus, as the caller noted, which means it's not as dangerous as a wild-type infection. But there have been a small number of instances of people in mostly low-income developing countries becoming infected with the vaccine strain virus. And so that is a relevant concern.
So appreciate the question, and we'll put some additional links in the podcast. This is Dr. Ann Zink. You've been listening to Line One, Your Health Connection. We've been here with Dr. Rivers and her amazing book, Crisis Averted, and encourage our listeners to take a look. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Learn more about Line One and listen online at alaskapublic.org. This is
Aleutian Peninsula Broadcasting is generously supported by the City of Sandpoint. Sandpoint is a first-class city in the Aleutians East Borough, located on Humboldt Harbor on the northwestern Popoff Island. Anchorage is 575 nautical miles to the northeast. The Sandpoint City Council meets the second Tuesday of every month at 7 p.m. in the City Hall Council Chambers. Contact the City of Sandpoint by calling 907-383-2696, emailing sptcity@arctic.net, or visiting their website at sandpointak.com. KSDP 8:30 a.m. in Sandpoint, K201DA 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS 88.1 FM in Falls Pass.